Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Sarah McCall's new memoir, Joy Enough, tackles answering the impossible question, can you explain what people mean when they say, you are just like your mother? Even as her own marriage splinters, McCall drops everything when her mother is diagnosed with cancer. Returning to the family farmhouse and laboring over elaborate meals in the hopes of nourishing her back to health. Mining the dual losses of both her young marriage and her beloved mother, McCall confronts her identity as a woman walking lightly in the footsteps of the woman who came before her and clinging fast to the joy she left behind. Again, the name of the new book is Joy Enough, a memoir, and it's a pleasure to welcome Sarah McCall to The Book Show this week. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The book is beautiful. I guess I will start by asking, how fresh was the death of your mother when you started writing it?
It was as fresh as it could be, I guess. I think I was in the midst of the grief when I started writing it. And I think it was the way I knew to deal with the grief was through the writing process.
Now, grief, of course, is something that lives with us, can live with us for a very long time, if not forever. So there was time between your mother's passing. You took time before you were ready to write. Is that true?
No.
It was almost immediate.
Almost immediately. I mean, I've always been a diary writer and a journal writer. And, there's that Joan Didion quote. I write, I'm going to botch it, but it's basically to the effect of, I write to understand what I see and what I think. So I think for me, I had never experienced the loss of someone that I loved very deeply, and I had never experienced such a depth, overwhelming feeling as grief is and can be. So the only way I knew how to get my arms around it or deal with it at all was to write. I didn't know that I was writing a book when I was doing it. I just knew that I was dealing with the emotions the way I always have.
How long has it been since your mother passed?
It will be 5 years in May.
And how long did it take you to write the book?
3 years.
Okay. So in that time, is it you, I realize I ask this question a lot, but is it you working through the grief through the writing, or is it being able to finally understand the grief that allows you to write? It's very much a chicken and the egg.
No, I love it. I think that I think so much of my writing is driven by a desire to understand something or to know something that I don't understand. So in my case, there is this question of who is this person, but also how can I know someone and continue to know them who's gone? I think I was in the process of trying to still understand my mother, this person who I'm apparently like, but is kind of unknowable to me in some way. So I was also trying to unwrap a chicken and an egg question. Well, who is my mother? And thus, who am I? And who am I without her? And how can I go on? So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's maybe intractable in some way.
Sure. Well, that makes sense. My mother passed away 10 years ago, and the feeling that I had was a feeling that I read in your book that I don't know that I've necessarily read anywhere else, which is the feeling that, why isn't everyone talking about this? If everyone has lost a parent, a mother, a child, a loved one, how are people surviving? How are people walking with their heads up and not just falling to the ground? And that was shocking to me then, and I got a sense of that in this book, of just what that is like to go through that grief process, because I was not prepared even remotely for that.
Yeah, I'm so glad you bring that up. I mean, because one thing that I have found so surprising in the process of this book coming out is that I apparently have a much greater level of comfort with my own emotions than most people. I guess most people are not totally succumbing to their emotional realities. But for me, there was no other choice, you know, and I understand how to some degree it's a luxury to fall apart, you know, our because as you say, our culture isn't built for it. It doesn't allow for it. You have to keep soldiering on. That's what we admire and respect. But I couldn't do that. And to me, it felt like the most important thing I had to do was completely fall apart. But yeah, and didn't you want to kind of grab everyone and say, like, I need to talk about this thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And to people who had recently lost a parent, well, why didn't you tell me that this was going to knock me down for such a long time?
Yeah.
In your situation, you find out that your mother has cancer and you immediately go to be with her. Talk about that impulse, if that is the proper word, maybe, of the impulse of why that was necessary for you to do at that moment.
Yeah, well, you know, my mother was losing a lot of weight, and her oncologist had really given her this instruction, well, try not to lose any weight. And she had always been the keeper of the hearth in our house, but she couldn't do that, obviously, quite as well when she wasn't in her good health. And, you know, my brother was bringing over bottles of Ensure and dropping them off at her house, and I thought, she doesn't want to drink that, you know?
Yeah.
So I just really thought, okay, I've always loved cooking. I was working as a food editor at the time. I thought, okay, I know how to make a chicken soup and, make a big salad that she'll eat. And she had done such a good job our entire lives. There are four of us kids feeding for us. I thought, okay, I can do this. I know how to do this. And she had taught me so much of what I knew about food. So it was kind of this... even though I'm sure there was a much deeper impulse, I was almost reacting to it on this very simplistic, practical level of, okay, I'm going to feed this person because they need to not lose any weight.
Right. Where are you in the birth order?
I'm third.
Okay. I'm the baby. That does seem to be relevant, doesn't it? Don't you think it is in some way?
Well, there's this whole theory. People have started talking to me, my aunt in particular, about birth order theory. Do you know about this? Like,
I know about it, and then sometimes it's dismissed, and I don't know. I certainly see some relevance to it.
I don't know much about the details, but I know that I think I'm supposed to be the forgotten child.
But you weren't to your mother.
Right.
And you certainly weren't even to yourself in the sense that you felt the necessity to be with her.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the communication like with your other siblings during that time?
You know, I think we were all just kind of doing the best we could.
Sure.
And that meant reacting in our own distinct ways. And so, you know, my older brother lived the closest. So he would kind of drop by and then be off again, you know.
Yeah.
And my sister lived in Massachusetts at the time. So I was kind of keeping her abreast. She would come and visit. And then my little brother was in China. So he was kind of out of the loop in some ways, I think, as he would admit, on purpose, you know.
Sure.
Some of us, I think this goes back to what you were saying earlier, you know, the falling down to your knees process of grief, for some people starts early before the person is even gone. And because of that, I think a process of denial can set in early. And I don't mean to say anyone was in a place of denial, but I think in terms of how much were we talking about the realities of the situation, we couldn't always just be talking about it. You know what I mean?
I remember when we were at the funeral home and they closed the casket finally, and I broke down. Not the first time I had broke down, but I broke down. And I remember the wife of one of my brothers turning to him and saying, see, that's what you should be doing.
Mm.
And I remember laughing at it at the moment, and then I was thinking, well, yeah, I mean, I guess, but you'll probably get there eventually.
Yeah. It's so... it's such a unique experience, you know, grief, because it's relational, you know, yeah. It's always about the griever's response to their relationship with the person who's died. And so, you know, we all have our own ways. It looks different on different people.
It certainly does. In your book, Joy Enough, you use that word joy. And I'm curious as to what your connection with that word is of the joy that came from this.
Yeah, well, you know, you asked about when I went out to my mother's house and it was summer. She's always been a very avid gardener and she, you know, wasn't well enough to take care of her garden. And so I took over these raised beds and was growing tomatoes and picking the basil and all of that stuff. And it was so instructive to me that this time at the end of someone's life felt so totally alive for me. I guess when I think of joy, I kind of have this aversion to the word happy, right? Like happiness feels, I don't know, like that yellow smiley face.
Right.
But joy to me is so embodied and about the pleasures of living.
One of the things that I love about the book, though, is in my profession, I get a lot of books about death. They're all gray. They're black and white, or they have roses or orchids on the cover.
Oh, God.
Yours, bright yellow.
Yeah.
Red lettering. It does not come off as, oh, this is about grieving and death.
Yeah.
I assume that is a conscious decision.
Well, I think it's because, I mean, the two go together, right? Like, my sense of both grief and of losing someone who I loved and who loved living was that I had never felt more alive. Suddenly it's all slipping through your fingers and you notice everything, the color of the trees and the quality of the light and the way your mom hums when she's at the table. And that level of heightened appreciation was to me so beautiful and so meaningful. So even though in some ways it's the most horrible experience to lose someone you love, it kind of brings you back on your heels about everything that's the most important stuff in life.
And oh, by the way, Sarah McCall,
yeah.
While you're dealing with this, you're also, your marriage is pretty much kaput.
Yeah.
So in some way, does this not help, but allow you to focus on something else? Meaning working with your mother and taking care of your mother, that is also a way of dealing with the grief of losing a relationship.
You know, I think it was more like the process of going and spending time with my mother and feeling really alive and really intimate with someone was more like the thing that made me realize the other relationship was not very alive, was no longer very intimate. So it was more like the contrast kind of brought into stark relief something that was very alive, which ironically was the woman who was dying, and a relationship that was already kind of dead.
So do you deal with both at the same time, or do you have to compartmentalize?
Well, in the writing, I found it much easier to write about my mother because there was so much saturation of positive feelings.
Right.
And I had to be encouraged by many readers and critiquers of the manuscript to maybe, you know, visit some of the details of my marriage, revisit them and add in some of that. And yeah, I found that was much more painful and I dragged my feet into doing it.
One of the, they talk about the stages of grief, one of those being anger. Did you ever feel angry?
About my mother?
Yes.
Yeah. I felt a kind of, I think in the book I call it rage, actually. And I think I probably am still kind of angry about it. But, you know, I'm angry that she'll never see me have a baby.
Like, right.
I'm angry that she didn't get to read this book. I'm angry about those things, like what I missed.
Is the anger in the relationship more centered to the other person in the relationship?
You mean like am I mad? Like, I'm not mad at her.
Right.
No, I wasn't mad at her. That's a really interesting question, because I know some people do feel a lot of anger towards the dying for any number of reasons. I didn't feel angry with her. I felt more angry about our lot in life and that this was what we got. It didn't seem fair. It isn't fair.
Obviously. It isn't fair.
Yeah.
You mentioned your mother humming. Can you still hear her voice?
Yeah, I can. And I have, you know, voicemails that I've saved and that kind of thing.
I live in fear that I someday won't be able to.
Yeah.
I think about that probably an abnormal amount of time.
Can you still hear her voice?
When I feel like I can, I listen to a tape.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing because I can see her, I can feel everything, and yet I worry about that one thing.
Well, it's funny, with my mom, she had this very kind of annoying, tinny, sing-songy voice, and we all imitate her all the time. So in that sense, it's probably much harder to forget. You're like, oh, Sarah, I love your book about me, you know, like, so yeah, it's present.
Give us a rough timeline of from the time she was diagnosed to the time of her passing. About how long was that?
The second diagnosis, she'd had breast cancer almost, it was about 4.5 years before. Mm-hmm. So when she was diagnosed again, it was only about 1.5 years before she passed. But it was stage 4, you know, when they found it.
Yeah.
So, like, I remember her doctor saying at some point, you are only alive through sheer force of will. Like, she just was so determined.
But you write about that. I mean, you felt that force of will.
Yeah.
I mean, you were present for that force of will.
You know, she talked about the life force a lot. I think she was a great believer in, well, the life force, I guess.
Yeah.
And I usually think that she was talking about the drawing together of people in their desire to procreate.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw in her another stage of that life force, which was just, you know, not wanting to give it up and like being so alive and having the spirit in you.
Because we get caught up in the fight, the fighting of cancer, fighting
yeah.
against the disease.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you at some point have to come to grips and not enjoy maybe, but to have the joy of that period of your life of passing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I remember saying to her once, like, you know, Mom, you don't have to be so strong. Like, you can break down. And she said, I'm not being strong. Or she said, I'm not being strong in her voice. I just don't want to get emotionally involved with this right now. I thought that was really interesting because I think, well, first of all, powerful sense of denial in some ways, but also compartmentalization. I don't think she identified with that idea of fighting the cancer so much as fighting with her life, you know? And in that, I don't mean a combative way. I mean, like, kicking with it, you know?
The process of cancer is so wearying, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing, too, of that is perhaps a difference in an equation of someone else's passing. My mom had a stroke.
Mm.
It's different because that there wasn't that just suffering for
right.
so long.
Right.
And the possible treatments and all that, which is a roller coaster.
It is. And, you know, I have to admit that I think I wasn't fully aware of how much physical pain she was in.
Right.
You know, I mean, now I realize the painkillers that she was on. But I think at the time I didn't realize just how strong they were, which would be indicative of just how much suffering she was in.
And suffering that probably she didn't want you to see.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, she, I was planning to go to her book club with her. I think it was the weekend after she died.
Mm-hmm.
And she had written her book club this email that said, you know, go ahead, make the plan. I'll endeavor to join you. And she said to them, I just can't express how much I love my life. one of the women in the book club forwarded me this email. And in a way, I found it kind of heartbreaking because it seemed like she sort of knew that the end was near, but she hadn't shared it with her children, but she had kind of told her friends, mm-hmm. you know. And this woman in the book club said, you know, don't be angry with her. It's a mother's nature to protect her children.
Sure.
And I thought that was all really interesting. You know, we have these different levels of intimacies with different people and what we can admit to them. It is wearying. Yeah. And imagine how wearying it must be to hold that in and know
sure.
who you can talk to about certain things and who you can't.
Sarah McCall is the author of the new book, Joy Enough, a memoir. The book is your debut, and as I was reading, I was thinking, wow, you're so good at this. I would think, you know, once you've written about this, you know, I would think you could tackle anything then, right?
That's what I say to myself every morning when I wake up. I just fist pump and I say, I can do anything. No,
this.
God, it doesn't feel like that at all, but thanks. No, I don't know. I mean, it is true. I kind of decide, okay, what is this about? Love, death, marriage,
yeah,
sex, food. It's like I did kind of cover some basic things.
Right.
But some people say, you know, you kind of always...
Those are the biggies,
you
Sarah.
Kinda, yeah, but, you know, I guess I'll probably be writing about those things for the rest of my life.
Sure.
Maybe I'll add in children, if I'm lucky enough.
When you think about what you would like people to get out of it and what the conversations have been like since the book came out, what has that experience been?
You know, one of my favorite things, one of my favorite conversations that has happened is people saying, God, I just loved your mother. I wanted her to be my mother.
Yeah.
I think she would just get such a kick out of that because she was such a maternal force, even to people her own age, that I love this idea of her kind of spreading this very loving and allowing mothering just to all these other people who weren't her biological children.
I remember thinking, and I still think this sometimes, but when I talk about my mother, that I make her out to just be a saint. And then as I think about it, I realize, yeah, she was. You know, I used to think, well, I have to be practical in this.
Uh-huh.
No, I think I got
I'll
it right.
Stick with this sainthood.
And for whatever reason, although I had an extremely close relationship with my father, I don't feel that same way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think my mother was a saint by any means. In fact, one of my favorite moments after she died was when the minister came over and we're all kind of talking about how great she is, how lucky we are. And he goes, well, what were some annoying things about her? And I wanted to hug him in that moment because it's like we really did have a lot of things we needed to say. Like how she, you know, wouldn't return your phone call and didn't open the mail and stuff.
Yeah, and those are daily annoyances, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but she, I mean, I can't get into it on
no,
the air,
I understand. But I think it's also the human condition that says to us, we are going to remember, for the most part, are going to remember the good things.
And isn't it interesting, too, because, you know, sometimes it seems like our brains are hardwired to be more focused on the bad.
Right.
But then when people die, those details get fuzzed out.
Yeah, if you make a pro-con list about the vacation, I mean, that con list is a lot longer. But when someone's passed, yeah, it's much easier to come up with the good stuff. No question about it. The name of the new book is Joy Enough. It is a memoir. It is published by Live Right. Sarah, what a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
This was a blast. Thank you so
much. For the conversation.
So
thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.